So good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Look forward to your spending the week with us, or as much as you can, between 10 and noon, or if you're listening to our nightly rebroadcast at 9 o'clock, wonderful to have you with us as you enjoy your evening. Coming up a little bit later, we pay tribute to Chadwick Boseman, an actor with not a super long list of films that he'd been in, passed away Friday, young age of 43. But what roles he had during his film career. We'll talk about those and the lasting impact of those roles. Want to hear from you, your memories of Chadwick Boseman's on-screen performances. But right now, it's our daily update on COVID-19. We're going to be talking with Dr. Dean Blumberg of UC Davis Children's Hospital. But again, I'd love to hear your questions, as we do each day, 866-893-KPECC, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. You can tweet at AirTalk or post on the AirTalk Facebook page. Dr. Blumberg, so good to have you with us again this morning on AirTalk.
Oh, good to be speaking with you, Larry.
I want to start with an interview that the head of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, Stephen Hahn, did with the Financial Times, in which he said that, and this would not be guaranteed, but that the agency would consider approval of a vaccine, even if it hadn't fully completed phase 3 clinical trials. He said, and I'm quoting, it's up to the sponsor, in other words, the vaccine developer, to apply for authorization or approval, and we make an adjudication of their application. If they do that before the end of phase 3, we may find that appropriate. We may find that inappropriate. We will make a determination. Dr. Blumberg, your thoughts on potentially getting distribution of a vaccine ready to go before the phase 3 has been finished?
This is very unsettling news and really suggests that politics has entered into the FDA and really reached very deeply into them. You know, the FDA is a wonderful organization. The career professionals are the best in the world. And we're fortunate in the U.S. that we can rely on the FDA to provide the safest and most effective medications available for all of us. But those kind of comments are very disturbing and suggest that a vaccine might be out there based on politics rather than the science. And you only get one chance to introduce a vaccine for the first time. And if it's not done correctly, the public is going to lose confidence, and we're not going to have high immunization rates, and we're going to remain in this current state of a modified lockdown for the foreseeable future.
Are there any circumstances under which you could see a defensible rollout of a vaccine before phase 3 is fully done?
I really don't see that happening. I mean, we're talking about trying to get herd immunity, and we're also talking about giving this to virtually every person in the country, in the world. And so the standards for safety, the bar is set very high. We want to make sure that the benefits of the vaccine clearly outweigh any potential risks. And so we need robust safety data before a vaccine is approved, not just protection, not just effectiveness data, but the safety data. And for that, we need large numbers of people studied. We need the data scrutinized by the best people in the world, by several committees, to look for any kind of signals of adverse effects. And we want to make sure when this comes out that that we're fully confident that we have a safe and effective vaccine.
Speaking of vaccines, there have been some concerns that some of the clinical trials don't have adequate representation of participants of color. And your thoughts on that? Is there an inherent challenge in diversifying clinical trials? And what's the potential risk if it's not representative of the American population?
Yeah, so if you go to like a northern European country that has a homogeneous population, it's really easy to test medications or vaccines. The U.S. is very diverse. So we need to make sure that any medication, any vaccine is tested in a diverse group of people, men, women, different ages, different underlying conditions, different races and ethnicities, to make sure that there's nothing unusual in terms of the response to the vaccine, both the immunity, the protection, as well as safety. And there's been challenges in the clinical trials in getting diverse inclusion. And so I know a lot of the studies have throttled down their recruitment so that they're not just enrolling, Caucasian white people, and they're getting people of diverse backgrounds.
We're talking with Dr. Dean Blumberg, UC Davis Children's Hospital, where he's the chief of pediatric infectious diseases and professor of medicine. Again, we're open for your calls at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. It appears that California is on a very positive trend when it comes to COVID-19. What's your assessment of the state of the coronavirus?
Yeah, I think, for the past couple of weeks, what we've seen is that infection appears to be at a steady rate, that the R-naught in most counties has been around 1 or below 1. This has been consistent. So I was really pleased to see the governor's announcement last week about the new rules for opening up certain businesses. I think that's a very positive step, and I think it was done very thoughtfully.
Yeah, what do you think of the color coding? We now have purple, red, orange, and yellow in descending order of severity instead of using state watch lists for counties. What's the advantage in your view of doing it this way?
It appears to me to be a little bit more simplified. I'm sure other people might understand it differently, but to me it's a little bit more simplified. The metrics are very clear in terms of the number of cases and the proportion of positive cases. And then the website that they unveiled, I took a look at it last week when this was first announced because I wanted to see if I could get a haircut.
Yeah.
And so it was really easy for me to navigate. And, it basically stated starting today that in the county I'm in, that hair salons would be open under the modified rules and guidance.
Yeah, I can't wait. Feeling very shaggy.
I have an appointment on Wednesday.
All right, good for you. And for those who are going to go to the salon or the barber shop, are there certain things that they should make certain are being done in the salon to make sure they're safe?
The number one thing is the mask wearing. So you should be wearing a mask, and your stylist should be wearing a mask. The second most important thing is the ability to social distance with other stylists and other customers. Those are the two most important things. The other things that they do, the disinfection and all that, I think that's much less important.
What about for those who are having more complicated, coloring and things like that, where they'd be spending, hours in the salon? You feel like that is still safe to do?
I think it's safe to do as long as people are masking, and I know with the coloring sometimes there's waiting in between. As long as you're able to wait in areas where you're able to maintain the social distancing, and if everybody's wearing a mask, I think it's safe to do. I have not heard of any outbreaks related to those situations when people are following the appropriate precautions.
I was looking at a story that was quite interesting about whether the testing that we do, and I think this is talking about the PCR COVID-19 testing, is overly sensitive. The threshold has been at such a point that people who have had rather low exposure to the coronavirus are testing positive when their risk of sharing it, of spreading it to someone else is very low. And the concern is that may be taking limited resources and applying them too broadly for treatment. What do you think of that contention?
Well, the PCR testing is extraordinarily sensitive. It's an excellent test. But I think every positive test needs to be taken seriously. The main issue with the tests that we found is that patients may have persistent positive tests even when they're not infectious. And so the CDC appropriately revised their guidance for when people don't need to quarantine or isolate anymore. And for most people, that'll be 10 days from the first positive test, as long as they're clinically improving. And for severe cases or for those who have weakened immune systems, it's 20 days as long as they're clinically improving. The test may be positive for weeks to months after that, but people are not infectious. And so it's able to get people out of isolation earlier. But in terms of picking up people who might be asymptomatic and have a positive test, the probability is that they're still possibly infectious. And so it's still useful to limit the number of infections and to limit transmission to know who's positive and who's negative, even with such a sensitive test that they may not be symptomatic.
So even with a low, I don't know if viral load is the correct term or if there's something else, but even those with less of the virus who are asymptomatic, there's still significant spread potential?
Yeah, it is a lower viral load, and it's a cycle time. So it's the number of cycles that are run. And if you need to run a lot of cycles to detect it, then it's probably a very low concentration of the virus. But people may still be infectious. A lot of the tests run up to 35 to 40 cycles, and probably over 32 or 33 cycles, people are probably not infectious. But doctors don't get reported those numbers from the lab. The doctors just get reported it's a positive or it's a negative, and they don't tell you the cycle time.
We're talking with Dr. Dean Blumberg of UC Davis Children's Hospital. Telehealth is obviously booming because it allows people not have to go in and see their physicians in person. Do you think that this is likely to continue in far greater numbers than it did pre-pandemic, even once we're through to the other side of the pandemic?
I do. You know, the telemedicine has been increasing slowly over time, and California has really been a leader with telemedicine. And I think this has really just given it a big push to accelerate that trend. There's so many advantages to it, and especially where I practice, where our area, the patients we see, a lot of them are in rural areas where it takes 6 hours for patients to drive to see a specialist. I mean, it's such an advantage where the travel time is just eliminated. And many of the things we do do not require us to actually be hands-on with patients. So I think there's a lot of advantages. There'll always be a place for in-person visits, but for a lot of the visits, the telemedicine, I think, does just as well.
My father had a surgery at UC Davis Medical Center last year, and I was sitting in the waiting room, you know, waiting for my dad's surgery, and I was just overhearing, how far did you drive in? It's the hours, you know, people from the far reaches of Northern California to get health care at the complex that you're at, Dr. Blumberg. Thank you, as always, for being with us. Really appreciate it, and we wish you a very good week.
Thank you, and you too.
Thanks. Dr. Dean Blumberg of UC Davis Children's Hospital joining us, Chief of Pediatric Infectious Diseases and Professor of Medicine at UC Davis. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC, kpecc.org, and the KPECC app. Coming up, we're going to be talking about Chadwick Boseman, who passed away at the age of 43 on Friday after battling colon cancer for several years, acting in some of his most iconic roles while ill. We'll talk about his legacy, and I want to hear from you, your favorite of his performances, at 866-893-KPECC, back in 90 seconds.